This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Is that the U.S. government has proven that whistleblowers will be severely and harshly treated as a way of deterring and intimidating people from engaging in further disclosures.
Glenn, the NSA has promised to come out this week with details on the plots that it says have been foiled by surveillance. Your assessment of what you've heard so far, we've heard talk of phone records being used to foil the subway bombing plot in 2009, and also your assessment of the news that the NSA is saying that 300 phone records were searched last year.
So this is the playbook that the U.S. government has been using for I don't know how many decades to delegitimize any disclosure, going back to the Pentagon Papers when they accused Daniel Ellsberg of helping the communists in Vietnam and jeopardizing and putting
Glenn,
at
we
risk
have 10 seconds.
The lives of American service members. So it's completely irrational. I think any of those claims should be very rigorously scrutinized because they don't stand up to scrutiny.
Glenn, do you have more pieces coming out?
Yes, we do, including in the next couple days.
Glenn Greenwald, columnist and blogger for The Guardian. We'll link to all his articles at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Birkenick, Phil Saramate, Nirmeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks for joining us.
The time is 5:01. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Station Navigator Report, June 14th, 2013. Recently, I announced a renewed effort to both survey the community to better understand what they want and need from their community radio station and to recruit many more financially supporting and voting members. Today, we launched the first survey in this campaign. True to KBOO's mandate to serve the underserved, and knowing that thousands in the greater Portland metro area have no access to progressive talk radio since the demise of KPOJ last winter, we are asking the question, would you like to hear the Tom Hartman Show Monday through Friday on KBOO? What does this mean in terms of airtime to meet the needs of the outcast liberal progressives in Portland? 15 hours out of the 168 hours, KBOO is on the air each week. Please go to kboo.fm and look for Tom Hartman on KBOO, then take this two-question survey. If you are not currently a member, please join us today. Pass the link along to others. We need to hear from the entire community if we are to make informed decisions. Please understand that this is only an informational gathering survey to guide possible future programming changes. Please contact me if you have questions or concern. My door is always open. This has been KBOO Station Manager, Development Director, Executive Director, and Ever Watchful Navigator, Lynn Fitch. Thanks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News headlines, the Army Corps of Engineers goes back on its pledge to conduct a wide review of planned coal terminals in Oregon and Washington.
We'll hear about a local effort to try to prevent suicides on Portland's Vista Bridge.
Analysts questions the claim by the National Security Agency that its massive spying operation helped prevent attacks.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 18th, 2013. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Don Merrill. A bullying incident at Bridal Mile Elementary School has brought parents and school officials together to deal with the effects of bullying. According to a staff memo obtained by the Oregonian, on May 24th, a fourth-grade minority student was cornered and tormented by a group of fifth graders. The group, which grew to about 15 kids, shouted insults at the child, including racial epithets. According to the school district, this was the second time in 8 days that the child was bullied. Multiple studies have shown links between bullying and poor academic performance, substance abuse, and depression. Oregon is one of many states that have passed laws requiring school districts to adopt policies prohibiting bullying.
The Vista Bridge is a beautiful and historic piece of architecture in Portland Heights that has been around for nearly 80 years. But unfortunately, it isn't known for its tourism ads in the 90s or its guest shots in Portlandia. KBOO's Don Merrill looks at the bridge's darker history and efforts to change it.
A touchy situation. That's what a spokesperson for the Portland Transportation Department called the issue regarding suicide barriers on the Vista Bridge. The 120-foot-high bridge in Portland Heights has seen more than half a dozen suicides in recent years, so many so that there are discussions underway to spend up to $3 million for a barrier to keep people from jumping off the so-called suicide bridge. But city budgets are tight, and as Transportation Department spokesperson Diana Dulkin explains, where the money will come from isn't an easy question.
Well, first of all, it's an excellent question in terms of how can $2.5 million be used, and there is no source for it. Right now, the Transportation Department, the city as a whole and the Transportation Bureau as well are underfunded. So those are very excellent questions. Where would the money come from?
But it's not just a money question. The subject of suicide isn't an easy one for Portlanders either, according to the National Association of Mental Illness here in Portland. Jason Renault is NAMI's local spokesperson.
Well, suicide's been a verboten topic, really, until very recently for almost all the media. It's a very hard subject for people to talk about, but from the mental health perspective, it's something that people who live with mental illness deal with almost on a constant basis. It's important for us to talk about and talk about openly.
Mr. Renault's office is directly below the Vista Bridge, so he speaks with authority about the need to talk about suicide openly. Another office that is directly below the bridge is that of local attorney Kenneth Kahn. He and his wife have organized a group that is trying to help the city raise the money needed to put up those barriers.
It's just not for the installation of the barrier, but it's also for a rejuvenation of the railing on the bridge. The railing is made out of poured concrete and rebar. It's suffered the effects of weather and cars colliding with it over the years. And so what's envisioned is that the railing would incorporate a design that was architecturally appropriate to the bridge to prevent suicide.
In doing this story, I heard that a lot. Historically significant, architecturally relevant. It's a beautiful bridge that has a beautiful view. And Jason Renault with NAMI thinks, sadly, that's one of the reasons why people choose to jump from it.
Well, it's beautiful. It's gothic. It's romantic. And probably, if you're going to jump off something, it'll do the trick.
But the issue around suicide isn't just about the bridge or just about money, but also about fear. Diane Dulkin said the city doesn't talk a lot about plans for Vista Bridge because it doesn't want to encourage people so inclined to end their lives to seek out a new bridge. Portland has dozens of small bridges like Vista Bridge. But is it a bad thing to address this thing that goes beyond budget and infrastructure for the Portland community?
Well, I don't think that a person who is determined to harm themselves is going to be deterred by a barrier on one bridge. And we could really spend all of our money that we have for mental health services on building new bridges or building barriers on bridges and not really affect the number of people who harm themselves at all.
Attorney Kenneth Kahn agrees with Mr. Renault with a caveat.
I think that he has a valid concern. In terms of addressing suicide, it has to be on several different fronts. So when we're dealing with a situation where if you provide additional services for mental health, which I completely agree with, men are still going to be part of that group who are not going to be seeking it out. And until we come together as a community and address a fundamental reason why men don't seek out help in a crisis, then finding the additional services for mental health is not going to serve them.
Diane Dulkin says that in the meantime, while discussions are continuing about Vista Bridge, there are signs on the bridge that give people two numbers that they can call if they're in distress.
And those signs give the number of two hotlines. One is local, 503-972-7000. 3456, and the other one is 1-800-SUICIDE.
I'm Don Merrill, KABU News. A Clackamas County neighborhood has decided to take the law into their own hands, calling themselves the Glock Block. But critics say the action is a thinly veiled cover for racism and profiling, and have challenged the idea that promoting guns is the best approach to improve public safety. The group of residents of Jennings Lodge community say that they are responding to crimes such as theft and vandalism. The group was started after 65-year-old resident Coy Tolanen failed to capture the thief who stole a gnome statue from her porch. Tolanen began printing flyers that say, "This is a Glock Block. We don't call 911," for neighbors to put in their windows. Tolanen is also in the process of obtaining her concealed weapons permit and says many of her friends are also armed. But when asked exactly who she is targeting by the signs by media agencies covering the story, Tolanen made vague references to unsavory characters and criminal elements. Some community members say that they are alarmed by the signs and the language being used, which is similar to language used by people who have in the past tried to segregate neighborhoods based on race.
The hepatitis A outbreak linked to an Oregon berry processor continues to spread. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say at least 118 people in 8 states have been sickened, and about half of those people were hospitalized. The states include Arizona, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Washington. Class action lawsuits in these states have been filed for those who paid for vaccines. The outbreak was traced to organic antioxidant blend processed by Townsend Farms in Fairview. The blend was sold to 12 states, but no outbreak has been identified in Oregon, Idaho, Alaska, or Montana. The Food and Drug Administration and Oregon Department of Agriculture have both inspected the plant. The FDA has not released its findings, but the plant has passed the ODA inspection. Officials suspect that pomegranate seeds in the mix that came from Turkey caused the outbreak.
Yesterday, a U.S. District Court judge ruled that the National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, did not have the authority to determine which Port of Portland workers should manage refrigerated cargo containers. Last August, the NLRB awarded the job of plugging and unplugging the containers to union electricians rather than the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. The NLRB's action sparked a labor slowdown from longshoremen, which led to truck traffic jams and prompted shipping companies to send freights to other ports. Judge Michael Mossman sided with the Pacific Maritime Association's argument that the NLRB overreached. Mossman agreed the NLRB does not have the authority to rule in labor disputes in which one aggrieved party is a government employer. The Port of Portland used electricians for the refrigeration job for 40 years until at least Terminal 6 procedures to a Filipino subsidiary, ICTSI Oregon, Incorporated. The lease awarded the operations contract to electrical workers, but the Port of Portland's longshoremen insisted the job belonged to them via a collective bargaining agreement between its union and the Pacific Maritime Association. ICTSI Oregon Incorporated is a member of the Pacific Maritime Association. According to the Mail Tribune, a representative of the Longshoremen's Union stated that Mossman's ruling, quote, confirms what the union has been saying all along, that the board's authority is limited and that in this case it should have been respected to our internal dispute resolution process.
Today, the Oregon House passed a bill requiring the state health authority to keep a list of potentially unhealthy chemicals used in children's products. The bill passed with a wide majority, with some Republicans crossing party lines to vote in favor of it. Some legislators said that they felt like the bill did not go far enough in protecting children. But Representative Kenny Geyer, who sponsored the bill, said it was too important not to pass.
In the case of an importer, that's someone who is a manufacturer out of state, sells here, but doesn't have a presence in the United States. If they have products that are harmful, yes, they are included. If Fred Meyers buys its diapers from Procter & Gamble, yes, Procter & Gamble will have to report if they're using chemicals in their diapers that are included on this list. If Fred Meyers has its own brand, which I believe it does, of diapers, it would then need to report. That is the point of the law. On the other hand, we have groups like G-Diapers here who have looked at this list of 19, and they've worked really hard to make sure that they don't have any toxic chemicals on an article that is worn 24 hours a day, 2 years, on a developing child. That is the kind of behavior we want. That's what we want to support. We have a lot of local, homegrown retailers and manufacturers who have stepped up because they believe in the goals, they believe in the feasibility, they believe in the balance of this kind of bill.
Today, a joint committee of the...
In addition to the bill to protect children from unhealthy chemicals, the House was also scheduled to vote on a Senate bill changing the rules on when parents can opt their children out of required immunizations. That bill was held over until tomorrow's session.
Today, a joint committee of the Oregon Legislature heard testimony on a proposed bill to address the state's racial profiling problem. The bill will not make it out of committee this session. However, advocates said today's hearing was important for legislators to understand that racial and ethnic profiling is a problem that needs to be addressed in the next legislative session. Here is a sampling of the testimony at today's hearing.
Profiling is one of the major contributors to the disproportionate number of African Americans in the criminal justice system. Although we are 2% of the population in the state, we're 10% of the prison population. And the numbers affecting young people are even greater. 18% of the state's population, but 57% of youth that are arrested are African American. So I guess what I'd like to, my main message is that it's time that we have a bipartisan approach to ending profiling. It's not effective in making our communities safer. Racial profiling policies set up law enforcement agencies as enemies of our community, and these are the exact communities that tend to be disproportionately affected by crime.
The data that show that 12% on average for the last 9 years, 12% of traffic stops are in Portland are African-American people in a city that's 6% black, also show that when a person is searched on a discretionary search, that is to say when the officer can decide whether or not to do a search, people of color are searched at twice the rate of white people.
My sister and I drove to San Francisco to visit my daughter, a Berkeley student, last September. After I drove for a few hours, my sister started driving. She happens to wear a headscarf due to our religion. She drove for an hour or so when she saw police lights behind her. She slowed down to pull over to stop, but the patrol officer turned his lights off. My sister continued driving, thinking it wasn't for her. She saw the patrol officer turn his lights on again. My sister pulled over and stopped. The police officer approached us and asked for her driver's license and insurance card. She gave him everything he wanted. The officer then stated she was speeding because she slowed down further when I turned on my lights and sirens. The officer was mobile and not running any sort of radar before he proceeded to us to pull us over. He gave her a speeding ticket, stating my sister was 5 meters per hour over the posted speed limit. And we couldn't prove him wrong. It was his words against ours. I'm sure it was because of her headscarf. I have to mention that this wasn't the first time. There have been other occasions. I witnessed this happens almost every time. She's driving and not me, who doesn't wear a scarf. She was not speeding, and I was sitting by her holding the GPS, tracking her speed, and the whole time it showed she was staying on the limit. It is unfortunate that I have to tell both my sister and my daughter that not only do we have to follow the law because it's the right thing to do, but most important, because we are also Muslims.
On February 17th of 2012, I was headed on the bus to volunteer at Free Geek. I got off the bus and crossed the street at 82nd Avenue in Southeast Portland to catch my second bus. I walked by nearby ATM shelter to get out of the rain. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. Moments later, I noticed a police made a U-turn in the middle of the street and pulled up in the parking lot of the Wells Fargo Bank. what appeared to be as a seasoned officer and a rookie started to aggressively question me. I asked them why were they questioning me and why did they want my name and harassing me. I didn't want to give my name or other information because I had done nothing wrong. The officer said he would search my backpack, although he had no warrant. I called my son to tell him what was happening to me because I felt threatened and scared. I asked him if I was being detained or under arrest. They answered that I was not, so I told them I would be leaving. When I tried to walk away, they knocked the things out of my hands and violently put me in handcuffs. And officers put his knee in my back and took me down to the ground. I still suffer from the damage today. During the struggle, I told them that they were violating my rights. In response, the officer used profanity and racial slurs and told me that I had no rights. They searched me under my coat and other private areas. I asked for a female officer to come on the scene, and they refused me. Much later, they told me that I matched the description of a suspect who had been rifling through mail, which was a Hispanic 5'6" male. I recorded my story and gave it to a member of the NAACP who turned it into the FBI. The FBI submitted my case to the Portland Independent Police Review Board. 1 year later, I still had not been able to have a hearing about the case, and I was notified that the officers had been exonerated.
Timber giant Weyerhaeuser will acquire Longview Timber and increase its holdings by one-third. That testimony at an Oregon State Judiciary Committee hearing today on Senate Bill 560, which would define and ban profiling in state law and require local law enforcement agencies to adopt anti-profiling policies. The state legislature will adjourn for this session on June 28th, and no vote is currently scheduled on the bill.
A coalition of human rights groups has filed a lawsuit against the New York Police Department for its decade-long policy of profiling Muslims in New York City. The lawsuit was filed today on behalf of a group of New Yorkers who were targets of the religious profiling. The suit claims that the civil rights of Muslims in New York were violated by federal and local surveillance operations. The New York Police Department worked with the FBI and other federal agencies for over 10 years to profile and target mosques and Muslim community groups in New York City. The operation is still continuing, but has been widely criticized since it was exposed last year.
Timber giant Weyerhaeuser will acquire Longview Timber and increase its holdings by one-third. The deal was announced Sunday and will be finalized in July. The Federal Way, Washington-based company, will acquire Longview Timber's 645,000 acres of timberland holdings in Oregon and Washington for $2.65 billion. According to Bloomberg News, the deal is the third largest forestry acquisition in the United States. Weyerhaeuser says the acquisition will expand its reach in international markets, and Pacific Northwest timber is strategically located for export in Asia. Weyerhaeuser shares were up 1.52 cents for a total of $28.70 yesterday afternoon.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after this newscast, followed by Out Loud at 6. On tonight's program, Sasha speaks with Tristan Cotton about his new book, Hung Jury, Testimonies of Genital Surgery by Transsexual Men. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is cloudy with occasional rain showers, high of 62. The chance of rain is 50%.
It's 5:24, time for the Daily Commentary with Jim Hightower.
Ironically, June is both the month of the summer solstice and of America's biggest blizzard. I don't mean a weather event blowing in from the Arctic, but a merciless storm of words blowing from the mouths of commencement speakers at high school and college graduations. This year, I was one of the blowhards, speechifying before some 260 graduates of my old high school in Denison, Texas. While it was an honor to be chosen as their ceremonial yakker, it was also truly humbling, since I was clearly the person that the diploma recipients and their 5,000 supporters in the audience were least interested in. Plus, commencement pontificators are expected to offer some sage advice to guide the grads, and I was all out of sage. So, I resorted to three admonitions I once learned from a West Texas cowboy. Never squat with your spurs on. Always drink upstream from the herd. And speak the truth, but ride a fast horse. Then, I hit them with my main message. Now that you've had a dozen years in the classroom and earned this important credential, don't be an idiot. I used idiot in the same way that ancient Greeks originally meant it. Idiotes were not people with low-watt brains, but individuals who cared only about themselves, refusing to participate in public efforts to benefit the larger community, the common good. The Greeks, I told the students, considered such people selfish, contemptible, and stupid, and so should we. This is Jim Hightower saying, the encouraging news is that this crop of graduates from Denison High nodded in agreement. After all, they've seen that idiots are running things in Washington and on Wall Street, and this fresh and refreshing generation of youngsters seems to be hungry for less selfishness and more togetherness as our society's guiding ethic. So, commence, I said, and make it happen.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Klamath River Basin in southern Oregon is facing one of its driest years on record. In response, U.S. Senator for Oregon Ron Wyden is holding a hearing this Thursday with the Natural Resources Committee in Congress. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Steve Pedery on the Conservation Director of Oregon Wild.
I wonder if you could talk about, first, the drought that's impacting the Klamath River Basin.
This is shaping up to be one of the most severe drought years on record in the Klamath Basin. Snowpack has been low throughout the winter and spring, and matters were made worse last fall when the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, the federal agency that runs the Klamath Irrigation Project, really overpumped Upper Klamath Lake and took too much water out of the system to provide for irrigation.
And what led to that decision to pump that amount of water out?
Well, you know, for years, the Bureau of Reclamation has really sought to prioritize irrigation in the high desert in the Klamath Basin, which is down on the border of Oregon and California, over other uses of water in the basin. And, you know, for a century, we've had this policy where the federal government has wanted to make the desert bloom. They wanted to bring agriculture to these dry areas, and they did it by diverting rivers and draining wetlands and lakes where they existed previously. So in the Klamath, what we've seen is the Bureau of Reclamation really trying to maintain that policy of promoting agriculture, you know, sometimes in places where it really doesn't belong, while, you know, viewing fish and wildlife issues, Native American water rights, the needs of places like the National Wildlife Refuges in the Klamath Basin, you know, as sort of obstacles to get around rather than legitimate uses of water.
Well, I understand that for the first time, the Klamath tribes are demanding their water rights to the Klamath River and its tributaries. What impact is that having?
You know, that has shaken up the system a good bit. You know, for a century, the Bureau really prioritized irrigation in the desert over all other uses of water. And what we have now is a situation where the courts have found that the Klamath tribes and other Native American tribes in the basin actually hold what are called the most senior water rights. So by law, their water needs come first, and they hold their water rights to maintain fisheries that they have relied upon, you know, for millennia. So the Klamaths have basically said, wait a second, until the fish that we depend on in Upper Klamath Lake get the water they need, we don't want to see water used for irrigation in the desert. So that's good news for fish in the lake, and I think it's really a, you know, a sea change in how the basin's been managed. You know, unfortunately, it doesn't solve all of the problems in the basin. The National Wildlife Refuges down there are still going to go without water this summer. Salmon in the Klamath River are still going to face very significant water cutbacks. And, you know, at the root of this problem is the fact that we've just promised too much water to too many different interests in the Klamath Basin. And, you know, every year for fish and wildlife is a drought year. We only really hear about it in the news when things get so bad that irrigation begins to be cut back. But the reality is we really just have an unsustainable system where we've given away, you know, more legal claims to water than there exists physical water to use.
So I understand that Senator Ron Wyden is holding a hearing this week. When is that, and what is the focus of that hearing?
Well, Senator Wyden is holding a hearing on Thursday to explore the current water crisis in the Klamath Basin and to hear from the various parties who have a, you know, sort of have a stake in that debate. So he will certainly be hearing from the Klamath tribes. He'll be hearing from irrigators in the Upper Basin in Oregon. He's also going to be hearing from conservation groups and from tribes in California. You know, here in Oregon, we tend to think about the Klamath Basin in terms of Oregon farmers and, you know, perhaps the Klamath tribes, but there's actually three Native American tribes in California who depend on salmon in the Klamath River and who have suffered substantially because of the declines of the river and the declines of those fish.
Well, I do want to thank you for joining us. Again, I've been speaking with Steve Pettery, the Conservation Director at Oregon Wild. For more information, you can find, you can go to their website, OregonWild.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced this morning that they will not conduct an area-wide review of proposed coal export terminals in the Pacific Northwest. Jennifer Moyer, the acting chief for the Corporation for the Corporate Regulatory Program, told lawmakers at today's House Energy Subcommittee meeting that the Corps will not limit its focus to emissions related to construction of the terminals and that it would not consider the impact of transporting coal to those locations. Moyer was unavailable for comment. The three proposed coal export terminals impacted by this decision would be located at Cherry Point and Longview, Washington, as well as a proposed plant at Boardman, Oregon. For more on this story, KBOO's Rebecca Ney spoke with Cezia Kearns, a senior campaign representative with the Sierra Club's Power Past Coal campaign.
Sasha, what is your response to the Army Corps' announcement that they are not going to conduct a review of these coal terminals?
Well, this is just a tremendous insult to the thousands of Northwest residents and local elected leaders, community leaders, businesses, community members from around the state and the region who have been calling on them to study the threats of these dangerous proposals and protect us from predatory coal companies. People have been asking for this for a long time. We know there are a lot of potential dangerous cumulative impacts from these projects, and the Army Corps is just turning a blind eye to all those concerns.
Why do you believe this is happening?
Well, frankly, the Army Corps, they have this concentration of power in D.C., and we know that we can get more done on the ground. And this is a clear indication that the coal companies, they have much more power in D.C., and we have more power out here. And so this is a clear illustration that we really need to rely on the leadership of our state electeds. We really need leadership from Governor Kitzhaber to ensure that our state agencies, like the Department of Environmental Quality, deny the permits that are currently under consideration for projects like the Port of Morrow along the Columbia River.
And at what stage are those processes at?
Well, we're in a really critical stage right now because the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality is considering a series of permits for the Morrow Pacific project that would be built along the Columbia River at the Port of Morrow. And if that permit is granted, then Amber Energy, which is a company that has lied to us about their intentions and volume of coal in the past at their proposal at Longview, they could begin construction at the Port of Morrow. And so this is a really critical juncture in which we really need Governor Kitzhaber and Oregon state agencies to say, we're not going to allow this to move forward, especially because there has not been the kind of in-depth cumulative impacts analysis done for these projects that we've requested from the Army Corps.
What advice do you have for our listeners at this stage?
Well, we have a tremendous opportunity for people to respond to this decision from the Army Corps by making sure that we get the state leadership that we need. And we are hoping that folks will come out and show their concern at a public hearing that's taking place on Tuesday, July 9th. That is a public hearing on the export terminal proposal at the Port of Morrow. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality is going to be taking public testimony, and we will have a rally at 5:30 p.m. on that day. The testimony will be taken from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., but we're hoping that folks will show up at the convention center at 5:30 and demonstrate their concern out there. And in the meantime, give a call to Governor Kitzhaber and let him know how important it is that we don't become the first community in the Northwest to allow coal export terminals to be built.
Sasha, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Sasha Kearns, a senior campaign representative with the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. This is Rebecca Ney with KBOO News.
Lawmakers introduced constitutional amendments today to limit corporate spending on campaigns. The amendments are a challenge to the Supreme Court's controversial 2010 Citizens United ruling, which held that corporations had the same rights as ordinary citizens' right to influence elections. For more on this story, KBOO's Patrick McLaughlin spoke with Robert Weissman, president of the political advocacy group Public Citizen.
There have been a whole series of amendments that have been proposed. Today, two senators introduced additional amendments. Tom Udall introduced an amendment that would give Congress the ability to regulate campaign spending. That would mean that that would overturn the court's holding in Citizens United that said Congress couldn't limit corporate spending and also other individual spending so long as it wasn't directed specifically to campaigns. And Senator John Tester from Montana introduced an amendment that effectively says that corporations shouldn't receive the protections of the Bill of Rights and other constitutional amendments. They should not be treated like real live human beings when it comes to constitutional protections.
Do you think there is a chance that these amendments could pass?
Well, they're not. We're not on track to win a constitutional amendment this year. That's going to require two-thirds of both houses of Congress and then ratification by three-quarters of the states. On the other hand, since the 2010 decision in Citizens United, there's been a real national movement that has erupted calling for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United and to go beyond that to restore our democracy. We now have 15 states that have passed statewide resolutions or comparable measures calling for an amendment. Oregon is on the verge of joining that list. 2 million people have signed petitions calling for an amendment. 500 cities and towns across the country have called for an amendment. We've got more than 125 members and the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate who are sponsoring constitutional amendments. President Obama says he supports the idea of an amendment. So we've made great progress. We've got a lot more to go, but we are going to get there.
My last question is, if the amendment doesn't go through, what are other ways people are organizing to oppose corporate financing of political campaigns?
Well, there's a long list of things, including at the state level, where people are advocating for public financing of public elections. At the national level, in the short term, the thing that has the most momentum behind it is a rule under consideration at the Securities and Exchange Commission that would require all publicly traded corporations to disclose their campaign spending. So they would be all the dark money that's been coming into elections in the last few years, corporate money that's been channeled through secretive organizations, where making it impossible to track which corporations are funding what. This SEC rule would require full disclosure of that spending.
That was KBOO's Patrick McLaughlin speaking with Robert Weissman, president of the political advocacy group Public Citizens, about recent challenges to corporate political spending.
The U.S. House of Representatives passed legislation today that would ban abortions starting at 20 weeks. The Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act passed the House by a vote of 228 to 196, mostly along party lines. The legislation was proposed by Representative Trent Franks, who said during debate that, quote, the incidence of rape resulting in pregnancy are very low, close quote. Republicans say the legislation is a response to a Philadelphia abortion doctor convicted of first-degree murder in the case of three babies born alive in his clinic last month. Samantha Gordon, spokeswoman for NARAL, an organization advocating for reproductive rights, says she is confident the pro-choice members of the Senate will keep the bill from reaching the White House, which has issued a veto threat. The bill argues a fetus can feel pain after 20 weeks, but some studies suggest that a fetus cannot feel anything until 24 weeks.
Today, the Google company filed a legal motion in the National Security Agency's Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, challenging gag orders on federal internet surveillance requests. Google's lawyers argued that the company has a First Amendment right to publish the number of customer data requests it receives on behalf of national security agencies. According to the Associated Press, Google's motion is aimed at brand repair following revelations that it is one of nine internet companies complying with surveillance requests. Earlier this month, former NASA technology contractor Edward Snowden leaked details about the surveillance program known as PRISM and published the names of corporations cooperating with NASA. Other companies participating in NASA program included Verizon, Yahoo, Microsoft, and Facebook. Google has published the number of data requests it has received from civilian law enforcement in the past. However, only the number of requests is available. The company has not revealed how much data it has provided to the NASA, nor how it has been used. Google released a statement saying that, quote, lumping national security requests together with criminal requests, as some companies have been permitted to do, would be a backward step for our users.
The Director General of the National Security Agency, Keith Alexander, vigorously defended the agency's spying program at a congressional hearing this morning. He gave the impression that the NSA's massive data mining program prevented a number of terrorist attacks. But a quick analysis of the examples Alexander gave shows that the secret database of millions of emails and other online information had nothing to do with thwarting the attacks he mentioned. In one example, Alexander said that spying stopped an alleged planned bombing of the New York Stock Exchange by monitoring communication between Missouri-based Khalil Ozani and an individual in Yemen. But as the Guardian newspaper pointed out today, Ozani had never been accused of the crime that the NSA supposedly averted. Another example was of a supposed prevented terrorist attack was the case of David Coleman Headley, who had planned to attack a Danish newspaper. But as ProPublica's Sebastian Rotella pointed out today, the government surveillance only caught up with Headley after the U.S. had been tipped by British intelligence. Here's Rotella speaking on a ProPublica podcast today.
The story very systematically is that the system failed with David Coleman Headley on many levels for close to 7 years. As he was traveling, as he was radicalizing, as he was training with Lashkar-e-Taiba and then with the Pakistani Intelligence Service, as he was communicating by email and phone for years while he was doing missions with high-ranking and sometimes known terrorists, the system never caught him, either on the high-tech level or on the human source level, because there were at least six cases in which people who knew Headley in different places went to U.S. federal agencies in different places and warned about him as an extremist, as someone who was training, later as someone who was making suspicious trips to India, yet he was never interviewed and that we know of monitored. So holding this up as a success story is particularly ironic and unfortunate, I think, because the system for so long failed to stop someone who was very brazenly involved in very extensive terrorist activity and communications with people who you would think would have been on the radar screen somewhere.
That was Sebastian Rotella speaking on a podcast for the investigative news service ProPublica earlier today.
The United States government will begin negotiations with the Taliban in Afghanistan on Thursday, according to a State Department official. The announcement came on the same day that the U.S. is scheduled to hand over authority in Afghanistan to local forces. After 12 years of war in Afghanistan, the U.S. has begun withdrawing troops, despite the failure of the stated U.S. objective in the war to root out the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The most recent reports from Afghanistan showed continued control by the Taliban of wide regions of the country. And Al-Qaeda has also allegedly gained support, especially in the autonomous region bordering Pakistan. Also today, the Taliban opened a political office in Doha, Qatar, saying that they wanted to find a political solution to end the war and foreign occupation. Mohammed Shaheen, a Taliban spokesman, told Al Jazeera that the armed group will continue to attack U.S. targets in Afghanistan, but will simultaneously seek to end the conflict by pursuing peace talks.
We have two options, because the military option is continuing for the last decade. Simultaneously, we have embarked on a political option. The last decade, the 12 years fighting in which America and all allies, they tried to defeat this power, but the result is our power is increased and we are there. So it is a good sign that they have recognized this fact, and it is good for peace and stability in Afghanistan.
That was a spokesman for the Taliban speaking to Al Jazeera Television in Qatar. The U.S. government supports the establishment of the Taliban office, but has not admitted that it signifies a defeat for U.S. forces in Afghanistan.
In an earlier story, the abbreviation for the National Security Agency was pronounced NASA. It should have been said NSA. KABU regrets the error. A bomb exploded at a funeral in Pakistan this morning, killing 29 people. Among the victims was a newly elected legislator who may have been the target of the attack. The explosion was the deadliest in Pakistan over a month, when a string of attacks took place in the lead-up to the May 11th elections. In Iraq today, a bombing at Shia Mosque killed 34 people and wounded 58. Two bombers coordinated their attacks, with one blowing himself up at a police checkpoint nearby, while the other slipped into noontime prayers and blew himself up inside the mosque. The coordinated bombers were the latest in a string of attacks to hit Iraq. The bombings have been mainly based on sectarian lines, reviving fears that the country is heading back toward the widespread sectarian bloodshed that pushed it to the brink of civil war in 2006 and 2007.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Good fix. Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, June 18, 2013.